Good evening. The FDA approves an emergency use authorization for the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. Morocco and Israel, is it another colonial deal? Bomb, bomb, how many nuclear bombs are there? And why the secret? More on a police killing in the Bronx. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, December 10th, 2020. The U.S. government advisory panel endorsed the Pfizer COVID-19 shot in a major step toward an epic vaccination campaign against the outbreak. The vice president of vaccine development at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals is Katherine Jensen. She spoke earlier in the day to describe how the FDA sped up the approval process to get the vaccine out.
We were able to enroll over 40,000 participants in a record 6 weeks, give them each 2 doses of vaccine, and ensure their safety while conducting the trial with strict compliance and uncompromising quality. And now, let me introduce for you the clear and compelling data package you will hear about today that we believe satisfy the FDA guidance for COVID-19 vaccine emergency use authorization. We have submitted all of the information required to meet the EUA guidance, and you will hear about them this morning. As for manufacturing data, FDA has reviewed the CMC data submitted to date for our vaccine and has determined that the CMC information is adequate to ensure the vaccine's quality and consistency for authorization of the product under an EOA.
And as the vice president of vaccine development at Pfizer, her name is Katherine Jensen, the FDA is not required to follow the committee's advice, but is widely expected to do so. Once that happens, as early as tomorrow, the U.S. will begin shipping millions of doses of the shot. Monday is expected to be the day the first patients are vaccinated. The initial vaccines will be reserved for healthcare workers and nursing home patients, with other vulnerable groups next in line until the shots become widely available on demand later next year. Meanwhile, United Kingdom health authorities said Wednesday people with a significant history of allergic reactions should not be given the Pfizer vaccine. The precautionary advice was given after 2 staff members responded adversely following their shots on the first day of the mass vaccination rollout in the UK. Both had a history of allergic reactions and are reportedly recovering. The advice also states that vaccines should only be carried out in facilities where resuscitation measures are available. Pfizer has been speeding up its phase 3 clinical or safety trials to get the vaccine into use much faster than usual. But U.S. drug giant Pfizer and German company BioNTech has said there are no serious safety concerns over the vaccine. Meanwhile, in areas of the country supporting President Trump, there's already growing resistance to the vaccine, some calling it fake news propagated by Trump's enemies. A recent poll showed only about 50% of the country are willing to take the vaccine, and Governor Andrew Cuomo is said to be effective. 75% of the population needs to take the needle. In New York, the COVID-19 death rate is now higher on Staten Island than any other borough. 25% of all fatalities in New York come from Staten Island, Cuomo said yesterday. Staten Island is only 5% of the New York City population, and the borough's death rate is now 40% higher than the other 4 boroughs. And it's the first night of Hanukkah as Jewish people around the world celebrate the rededication of the Temple of Jerusalem more than 2,000 years ago. To most, it's the Festival of Lights, where candles of hope are lighted, a time for kids to get presents, just like Christmas. But in North Africa today, hope for one group may be despair for another. Israel and the Kingdom of Morocco have agreed to normalize relations. That's according to President Donald Trump. He tweeted, "Another historic breakthrough today. Our two great friends, Israel and the Kingdom of Morocco, have agreed to full diplomatic relations, a massive breakthrough for peace in the Middle East." Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, also welcomed the deal.
"This is the foundation on which we can now build this peace. We'll resume liaison offices quickly between Israel and Morocco and work as rapidly as possible to establish full diplomatic relations. We'll also institute direct flights between Morocco and Israel and Israel and Morocco, giving this bridge of peace an even more solid foundation. This will be a very warm peace. Peace as never, the light of peace on this Hanukkah day has never shone brighter than today in the Middle East."
And that's Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. It's the fourth normalization agreement brokered by the Trump administration. Morocco joins the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and most recently Sudan in accepting peace with Israel. But this peace deal comes with a bullet. In response to Morocco's acceptance of the deal, the United States will recognize the North African Kingdom's 45-year annexation of the Western Sahara, despite decades of war by a pro-independence group known as the Polisario Front. 80 countries and the African Union recognize the Polisario, and the United Nations has passed numerous resolutions on the rebels' behalf. Dr. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. He's traveled to the region and says Trump is ignoring the Western Sahara's right to self-determination.
Biden could revoke this decision. However, in doing so, it would likely lead Morocco to then revoke its recognition of Israel. So Biden would be under a lot of pressure by supporters of the Israeli government not to rescind the annexation. So it puts Biden in a dilemma, basically, either recognize a flagrant violation of international legal norms or take a position that will get him in hot water with a lot of supporters of Israel.
Polisarios have an armed force. They organize themselves as an individual country. Will this cause conflict to expand there?
In 1991, the Polisario and the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which is the official name of Western Sahara, signed a ceasefire with Morocco in return for having an internationally supervised referendum on the fate of the territory. However, Morocco never allowed that to take place. Just this past month, the Polisario resumed the armed struggle after a 29-year ceasefire in response to a whole series of Moroccan provocations and violations of the ceasefire agreement. The problem with Trump officially recognizing Morocco's annexation of Western Sahara is that the Polisario Front, rather than being a national liberation movement of Africa's last colony, is now legally, in the eyes of the United States, a secessionist movement, therefore justifying even greater U.S. counterinsurgency support for the Moroccan armed forces.
So the United States could send advisors and could send potentially troops, special forces, to help the Moroccans because now we've recognized Morocco's annexation of this territory.
The United States actually was doing that earlier during the Reagan administration, even without the formal recognition. But this certainly makes it more difficult to challenge and would get an excuse for still greater U.S. involvement.
More an excuse, a requirement. I mean, the U.S., since they've recognized this country, if they feel there's a civil war in the country, ask for help, they might very well feel forced to help.
Exactly. And this is quite disturbing because a lot of Americans, even those who are pretty aware of U.S. intervention, the U.S. history of supporting autocratic regimes and crushing movements for national liberation, aren't very familiar with Western Sahara. It's a much bigger issue in Europe. In fact, there's a very active BDS campaign of using boycotts, divestment, and sanctions in order to end the Moroccan occupation. But it's largely ignored here in the United States, and that's a real shame because, along with France, the United States has long been Morocco's biggest supporter, and now it's become the first Western nation to formally recognize Morocco's annexation.
Anything like that?
Despite claims by Morocco supporters in the United States that the Polisario is tied with Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Hezbollah or whoever the enemy of the week is, the Polisario is actually a moderate leftist secular movement that has women in leadership and is has done much to look after the needs of the Sahrawi population in refugee camps in Tindouf, indeed in Algeria. 40% of the Sahrawi population has been under Polisario control. And those of us who visited the camps and have worked with Polisario over the years, while not uncritical, recognize that they are a relatively democratic, pluralistic, and progressive movement. And it's a shame that the United States, when we keep saying we want to see Arab Muslim countries respect human rights and have more democracy, support women's rights, reject Islamic extremism, etc., you actually have a nation that is doing that, and the United States is doing its best to crush it.
Dr. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. Morocco, a country with centuries of Jewish history, has long been rumored to be ready to establish ties with Israel. And two American bomber aircraft flew from the United States to the Middle East on Thursday in a round-trip mission. According to officials, the flight of the two massive B-52H Stratofortress bombers was designed to underscore America's continuing commitment to the Middle East. It's the second bomber mission in less than a month. The show of force comes after the assassination of a top Iranian nuclear scientist. Iran has blamed the death on Israel, which has been suspected in previous killings of Iranian nuclear scientists. And the Trump administration has denied a request from the Federation of American Scientists to disclose the size of the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile and the number of dismantled warheads. It's a big change from policy under the Clinton and Obama administrations to make the information public. The increased secrecy of the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal comes at a time when the Trump administration has been criticizing China for what it calls its secretive nuclear crash buildup. The head of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists is Hans Christensen. He says it's a step back for U.S. war planners.
It's been one of those numbers that used to be very secret. The theory for that secrecy was that if an adversary knew the number, certainly the sort of subcategories, but even the big number, they would somehow be able to gauge from that information about U.S. strength and be able to get an edge in some shape or form. And of course, you know, in hindsight, it's completely ridiculous, but that's what has driven this secrecy about the nuclear war stockpile. And then, of course, also that when something is nuclear, then just by default, it is always initially secret. What you saw over the years was that from time to time, you would sort of get little bits and pieces of it coming out. And especially after the Cold War ended, then you started seeing some chunks of information being released by the Department of Energy and Department of Defense, where you could get a portion, like early years, you would get the numbers from the early years. But it would stop sort of when you got up to the middle of the Cold War, the late part of the Cold War. They didn't want to reveal everything current. And then came the Obama administration. One of the first things they did was to declass the entire history, all the way back to the Cold War, like the total number, not the subcategories, but the total number. That was the first time ever that the United States had declassified that entire history, so all the way back from 45 up to 2010. And they also opened up a little more and declassified the number of weapons that have been dismantled, which is also an important point, of course, upon transparency, because you want to impress upon countries around the world and the public in general discussing these things that the United States is not keeping some secret giant stash of nuclear weapons somewhere that it can then put back on its weapons and things like that. So those were things were really important to sort of, both increase transparency, but also take momentum away from sort of conspiracy people and adversaries even suggesting that the U.S. is doing something it's not. So that was a good development, and it enabled U.S. diplomats to be much more proactive about pushing and arguing for greater transparency in other countries because the U.S. had a, great record. And here comes the Trump administration. It took a little while for it to get up to speed, and so the first year of the Trump administration, they did declassify the number and in response to a request from us. And then, the year after, they closed the gate. And so they've denied it ever since. So that's where we are today.
So do you expect any change under the Biden administration?
Yes, I do. I suspect that they will reinstate that transparency in the stockpile and declassify that number again. But again, I think it's not because the U.S. is secretly increasing or something like that at all. We estimate the number is about 3,800, perhaps a little less than that. The Trump administration has also proposed that it wants to build a new nuclear sea-launch cruise missile. And I doubt the Biden administration will continue that program. But if that were to go forward, then, of course, at that point when that weapon comes out, that would add to the stockpile.
What is the bare minimum necessary to destroy all, if not life, all modern and culture on Earth?
A few hundred nuclear weapons, the point being that anyone can try to put those X's on a map, see how many cities you can nuke, but also that if you burn them with nuclear attacks, it's going to eject so much material up into the atmosphere that it's going to have significant regional and even global climatic effects. So that probably wouldn't take more than a few hundred warheads to do that.
Hans Christensen is the head of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. 9 countries have nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, India, Pakistan, China, and North Korea. Israel has not admitted it's a nuclear power, but is believed to have about 80 bombs. Japan, Canada, Germany, and Australia aren't nuclear powers, but could easily have nukes. Japan, for example, is considered 6 months away from building its own bomb if it ever wanted one. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Hospital laundry workers rallied in the Bronx today, calling on their employer, Unitex, to provide them with 2 masks a day and the ability to social distance 6 feet apart in the workplace, something the laundry giant has been refusing to do during contract negotiations. Laundry workers clean the soiled bed linens and gowns inside Unitex facilities for some of the largest hospitals in New York City. The Laundry Distribution and Food Services Workers Union has been in contract negotiations with Unitex for months. Organizers say the company wants to cut pensions to workers, too. But the laundry workers are getting support from City Hall. Congressperson-elect Richie Torres and Councilmember Mark Levin stood with the workers at Lincoln Hospital today. The union's co-manager is Megan Chambers.
Workers at Unitex, which is an industrial laundry that has a contract to provide the bulk laundry service to all of the public hospitals at the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, including Lincoln Medical Center. So these folks are mostly Latino immigrants. They work at Unitex's facilities around New York City. These are industrial facilities. They're factory-like work environments. And this demonstration today was to call for COVID-19 safety guarantees for these workers, as well as fair contracts without concessions on pension benefits, because these are essential workers who have taken tremendous risks working throughout this pandemic, cleaning bed linens and patient gowns and medical uniforms, often contaminated with COVID-19. They have had no opportunity to shelter in place or to work from home. It's really been a sacrifice for them to be working at this time. And yet Unitex, in current contract negotiations — these are unionized workers with Workers United, SEIU — in contract negotiations, Unitex has rejected every proposal the workers have made for COVID-19 safety guarantees. And on top of that, has demanded concessions on employee pension benefits for new hires. And these are benefits that industrial laundry workers at Unitex and other facilities have enjoyed for decades. So it's just unfair.
Why are PPE being withheld? I mean, what are they asking for and what's being withheld?
The workers have a number of very important and, frankly, basic COVID-19 safety protection guarantees that they want in place. One is 6 feet of distance, or if it's not possible to provide 6 feet of distance at work, to have plastic shields separating workstations. That is something these workers have not had. And we are now 9 months into this pandemic, and workers really want that, and they, God knows, they deserve it. It's a basic safety component. You see it on the Centers for Disease Control website. You see it called for by the governors of New York and New Jersey, which are states where these workers work. And it's very important, obviously. And 2 face masks daily is another thing that the workers want a commitment on. Remember, these folks work 8 and 10-hour shifts, in some cases longer shifts, where they work overtime or where some of the delivery drivers work a longer shift. This is a long day, and face masks may break. They may become contaminated. People need to take them off when they eat and put them back on. And to guarantee workers 2 face masks a day who are working with COVID-19 patient linen is a very fair request, and again, one that Unitex has rejected. In addition to rejecting their request for requirements relating to gloves, relating to taking a look at the air circulatory HVAC systems to see if they are adequate for filtering out COVID-19.
This is sort of like what Mitch McConnell has been blocking the COVID relief stimulus package because of they don't want to have the companies affected to be liable, legally liable.
It's really disturbing that instead of focusing on the need to provide essential workers with safe work environments, folks are getting sidetracked onto the question of liability. Provide the workers with a safe work environment. Commit to do that. Then you won't have to worry about the liability question because folks will be working in a safe environment.
Anything you'd like to add? What's happening next?
There's a growing number of elected officials and other labor unions and community groups in the city that are supporting these workers. Unitex Corporation has multi-million dollar contracts with the Health and Hospitals Corporation and with voluntary hospitals in New York City as well to do right by those workers. So that's what's next.
Megan Chambers is co-manager of Laundry Distribution and Food Services Workers Union, part of the SEIU. And Ellen Trawick, the mother of 32-year-old Kawaski Trawick, a gay black man killed by a cop in the Bronx, commented on recently released police body camera and security camera video of the shooting. She says it's crystal clear from the video and the facts that NYPD officers Brendan Thompson and Herbert Davis unnecessarily killed my son, adding Kawaski was cooking in his own apartment, not a threat to anyone. District Attorney Darcel Clark cleared the NYPD officers of any wrongdoing last month. An attorney for the family is Royce Russell.
So much to the death of Kawaski Trawick that is reflective of classism, racism, and just complete failure and disregard for police protocol. I would be remiss to, if I did not say if this incident took place in, and we can keep it in the Bronx, we could just say up by Pelham, where the socioeconomics are a bit higher. And maybe the demographics are different, that we would not have this catastrophe of Mr. Trawick being dead and deceased and wrongfully killed. We can start from, as you said, standpoint of just simplicity. If you enter someone's home illegally and you think that they are a threat, which is a preposterous idea given the fact that when they enter the home, he asked, what are you doing here? Which is a question that anybody would ask when they turn around and their door is open and police are there with black gloves on, like they're getting ready to go tango. I don't understand the need to put on black gloves, which we see in the video, when you're responding to, at worst, a misdemeanor for harassment in the second degree and probably harassment, which is a violation and not a crime in and of itself. So why are you putting on gloves? And then you enter, and when I often say that when black and brown people ask a question, police and law enforcement don't perceive it as a question. They perceive it as challenging of authority. So when he says, why are you in my home? What are you doing here? We're not going to answer that question. That's a question that we don't need to answer. We're above answering that question because we're in law enforcement. What we're going to do is order you to do a bunch of things. And in his stability, because the picture that is painted is that he's some erratic person, so emotionally disturbed, he's running around and jumping and that. When they show the snippet, that I'm livid when I see that because it doesn't show the whole picture, and once again, it's just an assassination in another way of his reputation and who he is. I say this. He says, I'm cooking. Why are you in my home? Get out. That's it. Plain and simple. No one's in the home. No one's being harmed. You didn't hear any complaints about a man wielding a knife running through the building. What you heard is a man knocking on a door with a stick, banging, talking about, get me into my apartment.
What's going to happen? Yeah, to these officers.
I hope that they're terminated. History has shown me that unless people from the community and advocacy groups will stand strong with this family, history will repeat itself, and the officers will go on. They'll be transferred somewhere else. It took over 5 years, or close to 5 years, to have police officer Hayes terminated in reference to Romali Graham's killing. A little less than a year ago, he tried to get on the police force somewhere upstate, and if it wasn't for somebody doing due diligence, one of the civilian citizens in the neighborhood looked him up and brought it to the attention of the sheriff, then that's the only reason why he did not receive that job.
What should BAI listeners know? What can they do?
I anticipate that there will be rallies and there will be speaking engagements in support of the Trawick family and in support of having the officers terminated. What they can do is keep their critical thinking, critical reading minds on and support this family in their quest for justice and advocate themselves for having an entity outside of the district attorney's office resolve and look into these matters.
That was Royce Russell, attorney for the family. The Bronx DA's investigation allegedly showed that responding officers weren't guilty of criminality, but also revealed responding officers lacked information that would have been helpful when they encountered Trawick at Hill House. And finally, more than 63,000 New York State residents applied for unemployment last week, a jump of nearly 40% from the previous week. It's part of a sharp uptick in jobless claims across the country that reflects the worsening pandemic strain on the economy. Seasonally adjusted, first-time claims exceeded 853,000 nationwide, the highest total since September 19th. And that's some of the news for Thursday, December 10th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.